Well, last week we started a new teaching series we're calling The Advent Conspiracy. And hey, by the way, how about a big thanks to Joe and the 222 worship team for leading us this morning. Just seems to be a lot of talented folks around here, doesn't it? The Advent Conspiracy, the subtitle for our series is that Christmas can still change the world. And today we're going to look at a little bit further at what that means. Now, Christmas time is great. Because one of the things great about Christmas time is that we spend a lot of time talking about Jesus, which is super. Now, I've noticed that when we talk about Jesus at Christmas time, our verbiage and our language tends to be a little soft and cuddly. Have you noticed that? I mean, he's not just Jesus, he's the baby Jesus. And that's just cute. You know, babies are cute. So when we talk about Jesus at Christmas time, you know, he's always away in a manger. And he's not just away in a manger sleeping, but he's laying down his sweet head, you know? And then you've got the stars and everybody around, even the animals. Even the animals, to me, in my mind, they're kind of Disney-like. You know, they're all hovering around, just kind of looking down at the baby. It's just kind of neat. You've got cattle there. And as the cattle are lowing, the baby awakes. Of course, the little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. And it's just, everything's nice. Everything's just serene. It's a silent night. It's a holy night, and just all is calm. You ever notice that? Well, what we often forget is that for the people who were actually there at his birth, I mean, this is a real event in a real historical setting, and the people who were actually there, if they were to talk about the night that Jesus was born, that time that Jesus was born, they probably wouldn't use words like sweet and cuddly and, you know, cozy and silent and calm. We might be surprised to hear them actually use words like dangerous and nerve-wracking, scandalous. I mean, it was an interesting time. Now, Matthew, who was one of the people who was around at that time, he records this in his gospel in chapter 2. He says this about the night that Jesus was born. He says, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and they asked, where is the one who's been born King of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and we've come to worship him. And when King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. See, for Herod, the news that Jesus had been born was anything but calming. For him, it was disturbing, and for many with him. Now, why is that? Well, for Herod, the news of the King of the Jews disturbed him because, as you read on through Matthew, you see that Herod believed, he had a hunch that this Jesus who was born was indeed the Messiah of whom prophets had prophesied and the scriptures had foretold. And for Herod, he didn't really know what all that meant. What all does it mean for the Messiah to come? But what he did know was this: it had the potential to spark a revolutionary change, change that would impact him personally. And Herod knew that he would have to make a decision. Do I worship the Messiah or don't I? Now, last week, as we looked into the account of the time of Jesus, we came and we established some fundamental truths. Last week, as we began this series, we established the truth that everybody worships. Everybody. As we looked into the cast of characters around the birth narrative of Jesus, we saw some who worshiped him and others like Herod who did not, who went to worship other things or other people. And that's what we realize today, is that we all worship something. Now, what we established last week is this: the best way to be, really the only way to be, to experience life, is to worship Jesus fully. And when we worship him fully, we find ourselves kind of enveloped in this kingdom living, true kingdom living, the kind of living that can actually still change the world. So here's what we're going to do today. We're going to answer the question, what does it look like to actually live in that story? What does it mean to worship fully? To help us find answers to that, we're going to look to some things Jesus said. So if you have your Bible, get it out and open it up to the book of Luke. That's where we're going to be today. The Gospel of Luke. If you don't have a Bible with you, if maybe this is new to you, there's no problem. There's some Bibles scattered throughout, and you can have someone pass that down to you. They'll be glad to do that. We're in Luke, which if you're not sure where that is, there's a kind of a table of contents in the front to help you find your way around. Luke. Now, Jesus' birth It was riveting. It was earth-shattering. And oftentimes, his teaching was the same. Now, sometimes as we read his teaching, we kind of miss the full effect that it had on those listening. So sometimes when we read some of the accounts of Jesus, it's good to try and step back into that world, to step back into that culture. Now, here's what we have to remember as we look at what we're going to look at today. Jesus lived in a Jewish world. More specifically, Jesus lived in a first century Jewish world. And here's what you need to know about that world to really get the full impact of what we're going to read today. In Jesus' culture, in his world, in that first century Jewish world, everything, every dialogue, every debate, every question, everything, all came back to this one source. There was a point of reference for the entire community, for the entire nation. That point of reference was the Torah. You've probably heard of this. It was the Jewish scriptures. It had been passed down by their forefathers for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and it had been given to them by God. To say that Torah was important in Jesus' world is an understatement. Again, every dialogue came back to this. Every debate came back to this. Concerning legal matters, people would look to the Torah. When you sent your children to school to be educated, Torah was the textbook. People would consult Torah on how should I dress. People would consult the Torah as to what they should or should not eat. So Torah was everything. It wasn't just the law. Some actually referred to it as the very way of God. So if you're going to understand the things that Jesus says, you have to realize that he was assuming that the people understood Torah. So it's going to be good for us to understand Torah if we're going to understand what Jesus says. Now, here's the good news for you. Whether you know it or not, you already know some things about Torah. For example, thou shalt not kill. You ever heard that one before? Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt honor your father and mother. These are all parts of Torah. So the good news for you is that you already have some familiarity with it. It's the first five books of the Old Testament. But there are a lot of parts of Torah with which we are not familiar. For example, in Leviticus, look at one of the parts of the law that the Jewish people had been given by God. God said this, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. And don't go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the alien, for I'm the Lord your God. Now check this out. Here's what God tells the people as part of the way by which they're to live. He says, if you have a crop and you go out to harvest that crop, God told the people, he said, begin to harvest from the middle and work your way out. But once you get to the edges, don't take that for yourselves. Leave that. You just take what's on the inside. Leave a crop around the edges. Why? So that when people who come by, maybe the homeless, maybe the orphan, maybe the widow, as they come by your property line, they too will have something to eat. That was part of God's law, every bit as much as don't kill, don't steal, honor your father and mother. This was all part of the law. Look in Deuteronomy at what the law said in chapter 24. It says this. God said, when you are harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, don't go back and get it. Leave it for the alien, for the fatherless and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. And when you beat the olives from your trees, as we've all done recently, it says, don't go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the alien, for the fatherless, and for the widow. And when you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, don't go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the alien, for the fatherless, for the widow. So God says in this instance, he says, when you're collecting the olives from your tree, normally they would just go and just smack the limb real good and the olives would fall down. God said, when you do that and you look up and you realize that there are some more olives still hanging from the tree, don't smack the limb again and collect all the olives, leave those for those who are oliveless. He said, when you are out in your vineyard and you walk down the aisle and you're collecting the grapes and putting them in your basket, and you turn around and you look back down the row and you realize that you've missed two or three dozen grapes, God said, don't turn around and take those too, leave those behind. Now this was Torah. This was the way of life. This was the point of reference of all the people. So Torah was not just about the laws that we've heard of. It was also about your possessions. It was about your things. It was about how you let people borrow things and what kind of interest did you charge. It was about your paycheck. It was about your stuff. See, this is what life was all about. And for the people in which Jesus lived, this was their point of reference. This is what God had given them and the way that he had given them to live by. So as we approach what Jesus says and does in Luke, this is going to help us. Now, in Jesus' time, the first century, the Jewish people were under Roman occupation. That means that Rome was in charge. Now, the Caesar from Rome was in control of Israel, even though it was far, far away. Now, the way he did that, Caesar would appoint a local king over a nation. In the case of Israel, Caesar had appointed Herod to be the king of the Jews. Now, we know of Herod. We just read about him. He's the guy who was disturbed when he heard that Jesus was born. Now, Herod was not Mr. Popular among the Jewish people, and rightly so. When Caesar had appointed him to be king, the Jewish people resisted. So in response to their resistance, Herod slaughtered a bunch of people. It was a bloody mess when Herod came to power, but eventually he assumed the position of king of the Jews. Now, Herod was really good at a couple of things. The first thing that Herod was really good at was building things. He was a master architect and builder. Herod built things the likes of which the world had never seen before. Herod could build things, and we're talking first century. Herod would build palaces and amphitheaters and fortresses. Herod built this one fortress on top of a mountain that was absolutely unbelievable. It was huge, and it had places for horses and wine cellars and all of these extra luxuries on top of a mountain. Now, as if that's not impressive enough, Herod also built the mountain. I mean, a place where there was no mountain, he said there should be one so we could have a fortress there. So he designs a mountain. They go build it. Then he builds this impressive fortress on top of that. Herod built one time. Now, you know some folks will build nice waterfront homes. Not Herod. He built a waterfront city. I mean, he said, you know, it'd be great in this one area. We could have like a big harbor where we could do international trade and we could build the city kind of as a monument to the Caesar. So he did it. He had a huge harbor, a man-made harbor built, one of the largest in the world where people could do trade. And then along that harbor built a city, one of the most spectacular cities in the world. I mean, this guy was good. Probably his favorite thing to build, though, was palaces. He built palaces. He built many of them, palaces for himself and for the people who ruled with him. And the palaces, you wouldn't believe. I mean, seriously, he had this one palace that on the inside of the palace had a pool, like a big pool. And in the middle of the pool was a little area with a gazebo, so you could swim out to the pool and, you know, eat some grapes and have some Diet Coke or whatever, you know, whatever they're drinking back then, I don't know. So he has this palace with a big pool in it, which worked out to his advantage because when he had family members he really wasn't fond of, he kind of had a habit of drowning them. So I guess it's nice to have a pool in your house to drown the family members over at Thanksgiving, I don't know. That's the kind of palaces he had. Now, he also had one palace where, this is wild. He had one where there was, at the corner of it, was kind of this spiraling thing on the end. And when the wind would blow into the palace, wind would blow into this opening, and it would go round and round and circle around and basically blow air into the palace. I mean, first century home with air conditioning. I mean, what's up with that? This guy was incredible, and the things that he built, it just blew people's minds. Now, that's the first thing he was really good at, was building. The second thing that Herod was really good at was taxing people. I mean, he taxed people like nobody's business. I mean, if you're going to build these palaces, if you're going to build a city, you're going to build a mountain, where does that money come from? Well, Herod figured the money comes from the people. We will tax them, we will collect the money, and we'll build it with that. Now, depending on who you read, Herod taxed the people anywhere between 75 to 90% of their income. Pretty nice, huh? Good old Herod, everybody's favorite. Now, to make matters worse, to collect taxes, Herod would collect it by using one of your own countrymen. He would hire people from within the Jewish community to collect the taxes from the Jewish community. Now, that doesn't necessarily seem like a job that you would want, does it? I'm going to go collect taxes from my own people. That will make everybody like me. The way that Herod sweetened the deal to maybe get people to sign up to be a tax collector, here's how he did it. He said, if you will collect taxes from the people, I will give you a quota. You need to collect that many taxes from the people. But here's the deal. Anything you want to collect on top of that, you've got full authority to do. That's your income. Just work on commission. The more you collect, better it is for you. So now imagine, now put yourself back in the days of Jesus. Imagine you are living in this world and you've got a, say you're a guy and you have a wife and you have some kids and you're trying to support the family. Maybe you're a fisherman. You go out one day to work to make some money so you can put some food on the table. It's tough times. You work all through the day and even through the night catching fish. And as morning comes, you take your catch, you take it into town and you sell it at the market and you cash it in so you can support your family. And maybe your wages for that day is $10. You go home with your $10 kind of stuffed in your pouch. And as you get to the entrance of the place where you live, you're greeted warmly by the neighborhood tax collector. Yeah, and this guy says, so how much did you make today? Of course, being a God-fearing person, you're going to tell him the truth. You're going to tell him, I made $10 today. And as he takes your purse and opens it up, he reaches in and takes out $7. He says, well, good for you that you have 10 because Herod needs 7 today. And he takes your 7, leaving you with 3 to support your family. I mean, seriously, it's not good. And as he walks away with your $7 in the bag for Herod, you notice that he reaches in and takes 2 and stuffs his own pocket with it. Tax collectors, who needs them, right? I mean, they are becoming wealthy at the expense of your children. They're taking food off of your children's plate so that they can live the lives that they want. In Jesus' day, no one was despised any more than the tax collector for that very reason. For not only was he taking advantage of you, but he was defying the very way of God, ignoring the Torah. Now, among tax collectors, there was always a boss. The boss was the chief tax collector. The chief tax collector was the one who determined how much would be collected from you and your family, and he would send the other tax collectors out. So if the tax collector was really greedy, it was really bad for you because his own greed determined his own wealth. Now, look in Luke chapter 19. I want you to notice something. Maybe now you kind of have a grasp of the world in which Jesus lived and when he taught. These are the kinds of people who are listening. People where Torah is their point of reference. They understand it, they know it, and they believe that God has given it to them. So one day, Jesus shows up. And he's heading into another town. Look in Luke 19. We'll start reading in verse 1. It says, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. And a man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. Now look what we learn about him. He was a chief tax collector and he was wealthy. So what do we know about this dude? Yeah, I mean, he's stuffing his pockets with your money. All right? Verse 3. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but being a short man, he couldn't because of the crowd. So he ran ahead and he climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. And when Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and he said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. Now look at this. All the people saw this and began to mutter. They said, he is gone to be the guest of a sinner. Now pause there for a moment. Here's what's going on. Jesus passing through, the chief tax collector for the region sees Jesus coming by. Jesus sees him and says, hey, why don't you come on down because I want to go to your place today. And this upset the people. It upset them greatly because typically if you invite yourself into someone's home or would invite them to come be your guest, basically you are inviting someone to come be a part of your world or trying to invite yourself to be a part of their world. So when people saw Jesus inviting himself into Zacchaeus' world, they were disheartened. But Zacchaeus knew exactly what was going on. Jesus wasn't saying, hey, I'll come be like you. Jesus was inviting Zacchaeus to come be a part of his world. Look how Zacchaeus responds in verse 8. It says, but Zacchaeus stood up and he said to the Lord, he said, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back 4 times the amount. And Jesus said to him, he said, you know what? Today, salvation has come to this house. For this man too, he's a son of Abraham. And what does it mean to be the son of Abraham? It just basically means that Jesus gave him the highest compliment possible. Jesus, looking at this guy who's basically just confessed to being a criminal, basically, Jesus looks at him and he says, you know what? This guy, he is completely walking in sync with me. Now, this guy too is the son of Abraham. Very interesting encounter. Now flip back in your Bible a few chapters to Luke chapter 12. I want you to see another one, another encounter that Jesus has. And I'll tell you what's going on here. Jesus encounters a couple of guys, a couple of brothers, and they are having an argument. They're having a dispute over their inheritance. And they're on different pages as to how this thing should be divided up. So they come to Jesus and they say, Jesus, help us understand how should we divide up our inheritance? So to answer the question, Jesus tells them a story. He makes up a parable. Now listen what he says to them in Luke 12, verse 16. It says, and Jesus told them this parable. He said, the ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Now pause here. Pause here. Here's the picture. Jesus is painting this picture. Here's a guy who goes out one day and looks at his field, and the crop is enormous. It's full. So he collects his crop and goes and stores it in his barn. So he's got everything he needs. He goes out the next day or the next time, and he looks at his field again, and there God has given him like a full crop again. So the guy looks out and says, man, I have more food than I even have room for. I mean, what do I do with all my extra stuff? Now again, put yourself back in the time and the place where Jesus lives. I mean, this is basic, this is elementary Torah. I've got more food than I need, even more than I have room to store. What should I do with it? Well, that's an easy one. I mean, right? I mean, you should probably share it or something. Let's look how this guy responds, though, in verse 18. So the man said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and I'll build bigger ones, and there I'll store all my grain and my goods, and I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years, so take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who's going to get what you've prepared for yourself? And then Jesus said, this is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. Now, that's pretty heavy stuff, isn't it? I mean, God looks at the guy and says, you fool. I mean, this is the exact opposite response that we get from Zacchaeus. Here Zacchaeus says, whatever I've done wrong, I'll make it up fourfold. And Jesus says, yes. Now in this response, a guy's response is so heinous that Jesus says, no, no. Not even close. Flip over to Luke 18. I want to show you one more encounter that Jesus has. Luke chapter 18, another guy comes up asking Jesus questions. And look at what Jesus says in Luke 18, starting in verse 18. It says, a certain ruler asked Jesus, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Why do you call me good? Jesus answered. No one is good except God alone. And then Jesus addresses his question. He said, you know the commandments. Don't commit adultery. Don't murder. Don't steal. Don't give false testimony. Honor your father and your mother. Well, all these I've done since I was a boy, he said. And when Jesus heard this, he said to him, well, you still lack one thing. Sell everything you have. Give it to the poor and you'll have treasure in heaven. Then come and follow me. And when the man heard this, he became very sad because he was a man of great wealth. And Jesus looked at him and he said, how hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom of God. For indeed, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. Now think about this. Three different encounters. Three different ones. Zacchaeus, this guy with the barns and all the food, and now this guy here. In one account, Jesus affirms one of them. In another account, Jesus does not confirm and affirm what they say. And yet in another account, we see a guy walk up asking Jesus questions, eventually only to walk away. Three different stories, but there's a common thread going throughout them all. Do you see it? I mean, it's pretty clear. Jesus is making it very clear that there is a correlation, there's a connection between our relationship with God and our relationship with our stuff. I mean, do you see the connection Jesus is drawing here with Zacchaeus, with the other guy, with the rich young ruler? There's a connection between the way that we relate to God and the way that we relate to our things. And here's what we're going to have to understand. When we talk about worshiping God fully, when we talk about finding ourselves actually living in the story that brings change to the world, if we're going to do that, we're going to have the right kind of relationship to our things. I mean, that's what Jesus is saying here. So when we talk about an Advent conspiracy and changing the world, I mean, what exactly does that look like? Well, as we consider what Jesus says, you know, he gives us a pretty good picture of what it doesn't look like. See, living in the story of God, here's what it doesn't look like. When we have all that we need, when we have what we need and we approach our tree of olives and we knock down the olives and we have everything we want, when we look back and realize that we have more than we need and we go back and we consume that too and we make the extra about us and for us, we're not living in that story. When we walk through our vineyard and we collect what we need and we collect what God gives us and we turn around only to realize that he's given us even more than that and we go back and consume that too and make that for us, we're not worshiping fully. And I'm going to tell you, that kind of living definitely won't change the world. It's what Jesus is teaching us. You know, sometimes when we try and communicate something, you'll use a figure of speech, you know, just kind of a regular phrase that we use. And sometimes we have those. For example, if I were maybe writing a letter to someone, I might write a letter and I might say, yeah, you know, this one week in August, I mean, all week it rained. It actually rained cats and dogs. Now, if I were to say that to you, you would know what I mean, right? I mean, it rained cats and dogs. But if I were to write that down and send it off and maybe it ended up on the other part of the country and it fell under the ground and like 1,000 years from now, someone on the other part of the country picked it up and read it, they might look at it and have it translated and they would say, you know what? Like 1,000 years ago over in Buffalo, New York, one week it rained cats and dogs. Now, they may not know what's going on unless they know the expression. And in Jesus' day, there was an expression that was common to all the people. If you were the kind of person who went out to collect your olives and you hit the tree and the olives fell and you collected, if you actually left the extra olives up on the tree, people describe you as a person who had a good eye. It was just the phrase. You had a good eye. I mean, you were generous. Your crops typically had harvest around the edges. Now, conversely, if you were the kind of person who went out and you hit the tree and the olives fell and you realized that there were still more hanging up on the tree and you kind of looked around to see if anybody was looking, you gave it another whack or two and got all the olives, if that's the kind of person you were, people said that you had a bad eye. You know, if your field typically was harvested all the way to the edges, you know, someone would ask about you, hey, do you know old, you know, Micah? He's got a bad eye. You know, I mean, that's just a common expression. One day Jesus was teaching and he said something. Look at what it says in Matthew 6. Jesus was teaching and he says this. He says, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and rust don't destroy and where thieves don't break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Now look at what he says. He says, for if you have, he says, the eye is the lamp of the body. And if you have a good eye, you see that? If your eyes are good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, if you have a bad eye, your whole body will be full of darkness. He says, if then the light within you is darkness, how great that darkness will be. Here's basically what Jesus said. He said, look, you have a choice of how to live. You can worship God fully or not. He says, if you want to worship God fully, have a good eye. Have a good eye. Realize that God has given you what you need and then some. Don't consume it all. Don't assume that everything that you have is just about you and for you. He says, you live like that, your life will be filled with light. It'll be filled with good things. But, if you have a bad eye, even the light within you will be darkness, be pure darkness. Then to clear it all up, he finishes with this statement. He says, for you see, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. For you cannot serve both God and money. I'll tell you what I want us to do as we reflect as to what God has said. Here's what I want you to do. Just close your eyes for a moment. I want you to try and kind of block out everything around you and just focus for a second and give yourself the space to try and kind of process what all you've heard today. Think through this for you. I mean, ask yourself the question, why in the world did God bring me here today to hear this? How should I respond to this? And what I want you to do, just in the quietness of the moment, and again, just block everything else out, ask yourself the questions you need to ask. Take an inventory of your life. How are you living? Are you living with good eyes or are you living with bad eyes? Are you finding yourself submersed into the story of God and worshiping him fully as it relates to your stuff? You know, as we look into what Jesus says to us, sometimes it's comforting, sometimes it's just uncomfortable. And when we go through teachings like this today, sometimes it can be uncomfortable to examine our relationship with our things. And I think that the reason it's uncomfortable is because we're just so attached to our stuff. And I want to clarify something. I want to make sure you don't misunderstand something. This today, I mean, as we talk about the Advent conspiracy and what we can do to bring change into the world, you know, this message today is not a Christmas message. It's a Christianity message. This is about how do we live? What are we like as people of God? How are we? Are we people who consume it all? Are we people who spend less? I really want you to think about that this week. Now, as people who live a certain way, obviously it spills over into Christmas. It should affect the way we approach the season. And there are plenty of opportunities for us to kind of rally together and live out the Advent conspiracy at this time of year. And you continue to do that. We talked about providing fresh water for people. I mean, do you realize that there are 1 billion people in the world that don't have clean water to drink? 1 billion. That's a lot of people. 1 million people will die from that this year. So maybe we could give them some clean water. You know, it would take about $10 billion to fix that problem worldwide. $10 billion. That's a lot of money. Until you realize that in America, this month alone, we will spend $400 billion on gifts. Maybe this season we could do something good with our money. You know, this isn't a Christmas message. This is how do we live. And one last point of clarification. Maybe today you're in here and you've never actually entered into a real relationship with God. Maybe that's why you're here. Something just, you realize something's not clicking in your life. Maybe there's a hole or an emptiness and maybe you've come kind of looking for answers. Let me clarify something for you. Helping build a well or giving money to this organization or that one, that won't earn you some sort of ticket to heaven. Just doing good stuff. Going to heaven's about knowing God and having a real relationship with him. And let me tell you something, if you've never entered into one with him, I guarantee you it's the best thing that you could ever do. It's the best thing you could ever do. And maybe today you want to address that part of your life and you want to say, I would love to be a follower of Jesus. I would love to have my guilt removed and just kind of start life new. If you're interested in that, let me invite you just to come and talk to me right after the service dismisses across the way in the room called the Fireside Room. A lot of folks are going to just come in and visit. If you're a first-time guest, we invite you just to come and say hello. I'll be in there. Some other pastors will be in there. But if you're one of the ones who wants new life, I mean, you just want new life, look, just come and tell me that. Just come and say, tell me what you were talking about. How do I have new life? I'll help you out, okay? Hey, I want you to do this week, folks. I don't want you to forget what we're talking about. We're talking about being people who have good eyes. This week, take your reading plan home with you. Study it, pray over it, continue to dialogue with God about it, and let's see what he does with us. All right? God bless you, folks. We'll see you next Sunday.